Okay, guys, so here we are with Chris, the CEO, co-founder of Ollie. Finally got him on the show. Really excited to talk about your guys' amazing growth in this market, especially in North America, and your future expansion plans. And I know you are currently in the Los Angeles, your Los Angeles office, correct?
Yeah, we just opened up the LA office not too long ago, and now we're building out the team here. But thank you for having me on.
You're so welcome, Chris. So let's just start right from the beginning, from when you, because I know you just started kind of really getting into the co-living market back in 2011. Is that correct?
Yeah, 2011 is when my brother Andrew and I, we left our jobs. We were both working in finance, and we had full-time gigs that we were otherwise pretty happy with, but we saw a much bigger opportunity in the marketplace and an opportunity to be fulfilled at the same time. And we just felt compelled that we had to go after it. But even in 2011, that wasn't the start of the business that would go on to become Ollie. It was actually started 5 years earlier, the idea, when my brother moved to New York and needed to make ends meet. So he was in a one bedroom apartment that he could not afford. He ended up turning the living room space into two additional bedrooms, and he posted the spare bedrooms onto Craigslist with 90 responses in 2 days' time. And that was the aha moment for us several years even before we left our jobs to pursue the opportunity.
Oh, wow. And then the first property that Ollie had, it launched in 2016. Is that correct?
Yeah, so that's right. There was a long gap between the aha moment to the 5 years later that we left our jobs, to the 5 years after that we actually got our first building open. And so it just goes to show the difficulty and the friction in scaling in this co-living industry. But I do think it's getting a little bit easier, and I see some winds changing now that I think hold a lot of promise for what co-living can become.
No, which is amazing because you've been in it for a little while now. So it's probably nice to finally see that shift happening, I'm sure. Did you guys build from the ground up on the first property?
Yeah, the first property was started actually in 2012, 2013. And it came out of the New York City mayoral administration. Mayor Bloomberg at the time, his administration had held a competition to design the first micro studio building in New York. And it was not necessarily oriented around community. The challenge wasn't to build a co-living project. It was to build the first micro housing project. Part of the opportunity for us that we knew from the start was it wasn't just about right-sizing the rents for people. It was also about giving them a different way to live. And for us, it was a more humanized way to live. Community and creating a sense of belongingness being a very important part of that. That wasn't necessarily contemplated by the project competition that would go on to be named Carmel Place and Ollie at Carmel Place. But the Ollie piece came after, about 6 months before the building was due to open. It's 55 unit ground up modular build with a developer by the name of Monadnock. And the developer, the project manager for Carmel Place, had heard the Ollie pitch and had said, you know, I could just not ever envision myself living at Carmel Place until I could see the services, the amenities, and the sense of community that the Ollie business plan would bring to the project.
You know, and you guys, I mean, especially being in New York, right? I'm sure there's people that move to the city, they don't know anybody. And I, you know, watching your guys' videos and stuff online, you know, you guys are great about building that sense of community. What are some key ways you guys do that?
Yeah, community is vitally important to us. And we actually talk about our four C's in terms of what does co-living mean to a consumer? Why would a consumer be drawn to co-living? And for us, it's cost savings, convenience, comfort, and community. That community piece, though, it doesn't just happen organically. If it did, we wouldn't go for, you know, we would not have gone for decades in the housing market, where people literally might go for years without actually knowing even the name of their next door neighbor. And I'm guilty of that myself. When I first moved to New York, I didn't know the name of my own neighbor, but could because there's an icebreaker element to that. And we're all in our own ways, you know, many of us were just afraid of rejection. And if we put ourselves out there to meet somebody, it also means that we're opening ourselves up to not being accepted by them. So we've put in place community managers who live in the buildings. And a lot of times people draw the corollary between student housing or dormitories and co-living. And I don't particularly like that analogy, but there's one component of it that I do think is true beyond the densification of the floor plan. And that's the sense of camaraderie that comes with being in a community. And in a lot of ways, I think about the controlled environments of a university and how community organizes in universities is very different from how community, how we've organized the housing market. In a college campus, you'll tend to find people who share passions and interests tend to house together and congregate. In the housing market, though, we've organized by income levels rather than interests. And I think that organizing by income levels and the gentrification sort of that comes with that, I think it's created a lot of social ills that co-living stands to potentially break down. But it starts by organizing community. It starts by embedding a community manager in the projects who recognize that mandates from corporate don't work because every community is going to be a little bit different from the next. And finding the events that draw people out of their apartments, draw them out of their shells, finding those events is really where the magic happens with our community managers.
Yeah, and do you guys do any, you do internal events, I'm sure, within the community. And then do you guys do events where you invite the outside communities in?
Yeah, great question. So the way that we've organized community at OLLI is a combination of in-building events, which are organized by our community managers. And then we supplement with out-of-building events under a program we call OLLI Social. And you can think about OLLI Social as being almost like a membership club. That membership is free if you're an OLLI resident, but if you're a friend of an OLLI resident or even just a complete stranger who's a newcomer to New York and maybe we don't have an OLLI location exactly where you would need one, you can still be part of the OLLI community by signing up for OLLI Social. And that's a paid subscription membership.
Awesome. And then you guys have some amazing expansion plans, which I'd read, you know, before the show had started, I read your bio and some of your guys' plans. And I know I'm so excited. I was waiting, you know, Los Angeles. I mean, I'm in Europe right now, but I usually live in Los Angeles and I'm shocked that co-living hasn't taken off as fast as it has on the East Coast. So excited. You guys are going to be open by the end of 2020, right?
Yeah, it's, you know, nailing down dates for development projects is a fool's errand. I quickly learned. I mean, there's so many things that come into play. I do think that we'll be live and open in Los Angeles in 2020. It may not be the project that everybody has come to associate OLLI with within Los Angeles because there have been some delays on that project. But I do think there's many projects out now in the pipeline for Los Angeles. And hopefully we'll have a few of those coming to market as soon as 2020.
But we'll awesome. Yeah, do you guys partner? Does OLLI, like kind of like the Ulta by OLLI, do you guys usually partner with the actual developer in some cases? Yeah, yeah. Or all so cases?
We're trying to replace the developer. In fact, what we've experienced is there's a lot of value that the development community can add to co-living. We know what we do at OLLI, architecture and design work, the leasing and the marketing efforts, the organizing of community, the engagement of hospitality staff to provide services in the units. Those are all things that the existing housing market hasn't done particularly well to accommodate this consumer. But there are a lot of things that a developer does do very well that would take decades for OLLI to try to replicate those, whether it's relationships with local municipalities or trade relationships with contractors. There's a lot that goes into entitling a building and getting a project to a point where it's obtained its certificate of occupancy. And we felt the strongest, fastest way for OLLI to scale would be to find programmatic partners within the development community that tends to be rather localized or at most regionalized, who have developed those set of relationships that we can then piggyback on.
No, you're exactly right. I think that's the way to go, especially when you're trying to scale quickly. So that's awesome that you're able to partner. And a lot of those developers, I get those calls all the time, but the developers are looking for the operator, right? They don't want to operate the building at all.
That's right. That's right. That's our expertise is operating.
Yeah. And then the Long Island, so that one's still your largest property to date, right? 422 units.
Yeah, so our Long Island City project was our third project to open, and it pushed our bed count to above 650 beds. It's our third and largest project. It's 400, that alone is 422 beds. And the exciting thing for my brother Andrew and I is that when we started, when we received those 90 responses to his Craigslist listing in 2 days' time, we understood that co-living was not some niche concept. We understood that the opportunity for co-living was to come into much larger scale institutional grade assets. And so this is the largest and most institutional grade asset we've brought to market to date. There's more, a lot more like it in the pipeline to come that we're also very excited about. I have to remind people when we're giving tours of Alta, which is the name of the Long Island City project, Alta by Ali. I have to remind people when we're giving tours, you're actually looking at a time capsule. Everything that's reflected there was is a function of where the thinking was 4 years ago. And you think about where we were 4 years ago, how far we've come. The word co-living had not even come onto the scene yet 4 years
ago. No, you're exactly right. And then because you are built in, again, there are some other, you know, large operators in the co-living industry that are taking existing buildings and retrofitting and making them work. But they've even complained like, oh, we just wanted to start from the ground up because we would do things so differently because the buildings aren't made. You know, you're trying to make it work with retrofitting. So what are some things that you guys think when you're building from the ground up, what are some components that you guys are like, okay, because it's co-living, we have to build it this way or include this thing or think of this?
So the single most important thing is to achieve density. Density, it's not for density's sake, it's for the sake of all the benefits that come with density. Coming into a large existing building, these existing buildings tend to have very deep floor plates, which means that you're left with a lot of internal kind of core space that tends to be turned into amenities. And we like amenities, don't get me wrong, but having amenities on every floor can become a nuisance for some residents, particularly after hours. And just because it's nice to have a play space on the middle of the floor plate doesn't necessarily mean that the consumer has the purchasing power to afford that space. The consumer is going to be a lot more focused on what is their private space, their bedroom, their share of the rent, and anything beyond that personal space to them then has diminishing value to them and therefore diminishing returns to the owner of the asset itself. So building from the ground up allows us to get the massing of the building right, so there's not a lot of wasted space that we need a consumer to pay for. Not only does it allow us to drop the price point lower to the consumer, it also drives higher dollar per square foot rents. So the higher dollar per square foot rents then becomes the mechanism by which we can fund reinvestment back into other areas of the resident's experience that we know they value a lot more and that do a lot more to define overall quality of life for them than floor area alone. And those things range from, you know, housekeeping on a weekly basis, linen changes and towel changes, bath amenities being provided, having a fully furnished space, having, because it is small space that we're working with at Ollie, having furniture that transforms where a bed becomes a sofa or a desk becomes a dining table. And then being able to fund the community events that I was mentioning earlier, things like, you know, snowshoeing and whiskey tasting. That was a recent event that we held. Those don't cost our residents anything. Those are all funded by Ollie, but ultimately by the fact that we're achieving a higher dollar per square foot rent thanks to density.
Yeah. No, and okay, so let's talk about this. This actually dovetails great into the next question with it, which is banking, the financing, right? So these banks, and I have friends that are in the banking industry that fund these huge multi-unit complexes. And recently they're like, yeah, Christine, we're you know, giving enough risk in the sense that co-living's so new that maybe it's 10% of a project we're going to allow for co-living. You know, there's still, I don't know if you're finding this when you're getting funding for these projects, or do you take outside investment or VC money? Are you guys doing it differently?
So Ollie to date has been funded by more traditional real estate dollars. We, by choice, ended up not going the VC route because we wanted to send a message that Ollie was the most institutional grade platform, or a very institutional grade platform that was safe for real estate investors, right? Because the venture capital community, they're not going to fund the hundreds of millions, or really, if you look across our pipeline now, there's something like $7 billion of total project capitalization sitting in the pipeline. And a venture capital firm that's looking for a 40% or better annual return on their investment, they're not going to fund real estate, brick and mortar, to that, you know, to that tune. So we knew that we needed to unlock dollars from much more conservative capital, the real estate, the institutional real estate investor community. And there was a lot that came with how we set up our floor plans, how we structure our lease agreements with residents. There's a whole slew of decisions that then followed suit off of understanding what was going to be necessary to have real estate investors commit to a project. One of the things you mentioned was quite important for our Long Island City project was there we only represent 1/3 of the total building. So our 422 beds, although it's quite a lot in its own right, really only represents about 1/3 of the project's total floor area. What it's done though is if you look at who our consumer is, save for about 10% of the consumers renting at Ollie, they're earning less than $100,000 a year. The conventional apartments above us, the opening price point is about $2,500 a month for a studio in the conventional floors above us. Mm-hmm. That means that the resident would have had to earn $100,000 a year simply to qualify for living in that building otherwise. Our residents, at mostly at $100,000 and under, are not cannibalizing the floors upstairs. And so the fact that we have kept pace actually slightly ahead of the absorption of the conventional apartments means that the whole building is absorbing that much faster, something like 4 or 5 months faster than it otherwise would have absorbed without Ollie. That then allows us to deliver a message of de-risking as opposed to adding risk to a project.
No, and that's awesome, Chris, because that helps the entire industry. So I love hearing that, right? Because then people get more comfortable when you're showing those numbers and those metrics and that history. And again, it's not, I know we're still in the beginnings, but at least you have some track record in history where it's like, well, look, this is overperforming. So as an asset class, I love hearing that. Do they, so that, what was that?
And it's also created a perfect side-by-side case study in the economics, not just the absorption, but also the dollar per square foot revenue, the dollar per square foot income. And so we've been able to use that to our advantage in driving acceptance, broader acceptance, of the co-living asset class within the industry.
And then does that mean you require a 12-month lease minimum on these projects, on the units?
Yes. Even though operationally Ollie can manage down to a nightly stay, doesn't mean that that's what the investor or the owner of the asset wants. And even if the owner of the asset wants it, doesn't necessarily mean they could do it, because we also have to look at what zoning and building code requirements call for.
So across the board, you guys are 1 year, 12 month minimum.
Well, we look at each asset on a case by case basis. And we also have a discussion with what the owner's objectives are. And if everything aligns, then we offer a shorter duration stay. But the brand promise to the consumer is not that Ollie is going to offer them flexibility in the lease term. And so I know for some co-living operators, that is the distinction that they are making, that they can accommodate a resident nightly and they can do that in any of their projects. For Ollie, that's not the case. But I also don't think that that's the biggest pain point that when we started the business, we were trying to solve. We weren't trying to solve a pain point of the consumer needing a new place to stay every month. We were trying to solve the pain point of a consumer needing an affordable place that preserves a sense of dignity for them for the next 12 or 24 months.
Got it. Yeah. And then it builds a stable community too, right? Because you have people not coming in and out so frequently. So yeah, I could definitely see how there'd be more pros and cons to that. And then let me see what other, what's your demographic, like age range, typical demographic?
It's so interesting. So it's good that you said typical and not average. Because a lot of times you ask the question, what is the average age? And I think, you know, the average age would take you to a very misleading conclusion. And the reason for that is because there's actually a bit of a barbell right now. The co-living consumer today tends to be either a younger, say, millennial, 22 to 35 years old, or a 55 and over consumer. And it's the space in between, which is more of kind of a family market, and where you have individual, or we have families who are nesting together. It's that space in between that has sort of been left out of most of the co-living conversation to date. I do think there's an opportunity within that family space too, but our typical consumer within the, for the floor plans as we've created them in the shared suites, tends to draw a younger consumer, say like a younger millennial, whereas the micro studio product, because we play along this whole price privacy spectrum where some people share a space or some people live in a studio of their own, that doesn't define for us if they're part of the community or not. It just defines whether they have their own kitchen and their own bathroom. But that more privacy provided in a micro studio unit tends to draw an older demographic, that 55 plus, as well as an older millennial. And it's just reflecting that purchasing power.
And that middle, you're right, that middle sector. So I don't know if you saw, you probably heard it this week, that their Common, Brad Hargraves of the Common, is doing the Kin Project, which is like targeting families. I actually was really excited to hear that, because that hasn't been done yet. And you're right, that's the missing middle piece. So it'll be interesting.
I definitely think that they're onto something, and I look forward to having Ollie's announcement of our own in the near future. But there's a huge opportunity within that family space, and Brad's exactly right. I mean, there's a lot of consumers who would like to stay more cosmopolitan in raising a family, but they've been priced out and that option's therefore not available to them.
Yeah, no, definitely. So good deal. So what is your, let's see, do you ever stay at any of it? Do you live offsite? Do you live in any of the buildings at Ollie, or do you live somewhere else?
Yeah, so I don't live in the buildings currently, although because I am back and forth between LA and New York a lot as we're out here setting up the LA space, I'm looking at whether it still makes sense to even have a place in New York. And certainly if the answer is no on that front, the option of staying with Ollie would be my first choice.
Yes, of course. Oh, of course. That's awesome. And then do you guys have co-working spaces built in on any of the properties, in some of the common spaces?
We do, and it's a very popular amenity, so much so that we're becoming even more intentional and deliberate about how we design those spaces, just getting a lot smarter about how we design the co-working spaces in our future projects. But we have created co-working spaces in our existing projects. They're not quite as robust as I'd like to see them in our future projects.
But again, and you can tell you really pay closely attention to like each project, and then you see and you learn. It sounds like you learned from the last one, like, oh, they're using this from the co-working space more. Let's, you know, so again, that's a huge advantage. Again, from building ground up, you probably take the lessons learned, right, from the prior.
And it's so funny. That's exactly right. I mean, we're on our what we call Ollie 3.0 brand standard right now, and we have three buildings. So go figure. Every building, we learn something new.
Yeah, no, which makes sense. And that's great. And you care about the consumer and you care about the product. Like, it's obvious. So that you guys are making those changes as you go. How many units total do you guys have now between the three properties total?
So it must be, let's see. I'm just doing some math in my head. I guess it's about close to 400 units. About 350 to 400 units in total, and then 653 beds.
Oh yeah, because people, some of them share.
Open. And then there's six more that are signed up at different stages of development currently. Those represent about 1,300 additional beds. And then the very exciting thing that's happening, and I'm sure you're seeing this as well, is in the pipeline, the opportunities that we're seeing that we're now negotiating or that we're evaluating, something like 90 projects, large scale projects, and they represent, I think those 90 projects represent over 20,000 beds.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's exciting times, you know, and what we're experiencing, I'm sure, is indicative of what's happening across the co-living universe right now. So it's a very exciting time for co-living in general.
No, it is. It is. And it was like those two announcements back in December, you know, when PMG and Medici both announced billion-dollar injections into co-living. When the word billion next to co-living was in a news article 2 weeks apart, I was like, okay, finally, here we go. It's not a fad anymore, because I'm sure you heard that a lot. Oh, co-living's a fad.
Well, 20,000 beds sounds like a lot, right? But when we look at the demand studies, the U.S. alone, we think, can support 6 million before even accounting for that family slice. And so if that's just the U.S. and 20,000 is just a drop of the 6 million, and you think that the 20,000 beds will take almost $7 billion of total project capitalization to bring to market, this is a industry that could measure actually into the trillions.
See, Chris, this is where your background in finance comes in handy. That's amazing. That's awesome. Okay, well, we're wrapping up. So just a couple of last questions. What did you guys build your own tech? Like, what technology do you guys use behind the scenes for the management, the bookings, all that?
Yeah, so we built our own tech. However, we didn't want to create switching costs for our developer partners. So the back end of our technology actually ends up becoming a middleware that snaps onto all of the existing typical property management systems. So the consumer gets the benefit of an interface that's streamlined. They're only downloading one app and everything's there for them. But the developer partner gets the benefit of keeping all of their same systems that they've already trained their whole personnel on.
That's awesome. And then they just connect and integrate together.
Right, for their, yeah.
That's awesome. Right. That's awesome. And then, okay, so last question, Chris, which I know we touched on. Where do you see, especially with the numbers, you already know all those numbers off the top of your head. Where do you see just the future of co-living if you fast forward 5 or 10 years out?
Yeah, I don't see any reason to think that penetration of co-living into housing will be any less than co-working into the office industry. And I do think it's gonna take billions, multiple billions of dollars to unlock that potential. So I think getting this conservative investor group to reframe their perception of risk when they think about co-living, that's where my mission is right now.
Awesome. Perfect way to end this interview. Thank you again so much for your time. I know you're a busy guy, and we look forward to Los Angeles opening.
Looking forward to it as well. Thank you so much, Christine.
Okay, bye.